Have you ever longed to escape reality? Or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
All right, settle in. We got a lot to talk about. One of Harvey Weinstein's convictions was overturned. We'll get into what that means for me, too. Also, Zendaya's new movie, Challengers, just came out. You'll hear how she's become one of the biggest stars in the world. The group chat is here. Let's go. I'm Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud. This is Commotion. Okay, look, there is one story that is dominating the headlines right now. On Thursday, the highest court in New York overturned Harvey Weinstein's 2020 conviction on felony sex crime charges. Now, this doesn't mean that he's going to get out anytime soon. Weinstein was convicted of 16 years, was sentenced to 16 years for rape in a separate case. But the impact of this latest ruling is really significant. The Weinstein case, of course, helped kick off this modern Me Too movement. And I'm glad that we have the group chat that we have today to talk about it. Hannah Flint is here. Kathleen Newman-Bermang is here and Jackson Weaver is here. Kathleen, Hannah, and Jackson, welcome to the show, everybody.
Hello.
Hi, Alamine.
Hi.
Listen, let's get right into it. Kathleen, what was your reaction when you first heard that Weinstein's conviction was being overturned?
I mean, I think the overwhelming emotion I felt was sadness for the victims. And, you know, some have come out publicly, like Ashley Judd, some other notable names have come out and said how heartbreaking this all is for them. But I can't imagine how they are feeling through all of this. And then, you know, maybe rage a close second. But I wasn't shocked, I think, which is also sad. We know how often the justice system fails victims of sexual assault. We also know that powerful men are often protected by that same system. And then when I read more about it, it was also really infuriating that it felt like this decision was based on a legal technicality, you know, that essentially too many women came forward to testify against him and that not all of those women were included in the charges against him. But the point was to prove a pattern of behavior. So it just didn't make a lot of sense. And even though it didn't make a lot of sense, it also felt like, oh yeah, that tracks. You know, this powerful white man gets another chance because of semantics while his victims have to relive all of this. And while there are so many Black and Brown people sitting in prisons who will never have this opportunity, who are more deserving. So overall, it was frustrating and sad, and I think indicative of larger systemic issues and of this moment we're in now.
We should explain the what you're calling the technicality there. So like the basically what happened is this: the conviction was overturned because of what they call the Molyneux witnesses. These witnesses were witnesses who came and they testified that he had assaulted them, but they were not specifically the cases at the trial. They were not bringing charges forward, but they came and they testified that they had been assaulted by Harvey Weinstein. And from what I can tell from some legal observers, they actually kind of thought that the case against him was kind of sloppy to begin with, because they would have known that these cases would be, you know, a little bit treacherous for the defense. Like a little bit later, it would be very easy, I guess, for the defense to say they shouldn't have brought these witnesses forward. So these women in many ways were not protected by being used in this very specific way. Hannah, I want to get your reaction in just a moment. But first, I want to play a clip of Ashley Judd. Let's hear her right now.
It's a hard day for survivors, but we live in our truth. We know what happened, and the truth is consistent. You know, when Harvey sexually harassed me and then defamed and interfered with my economic and creative opportunities after I escaped him in that hotel room in 1996, I told anyone who would listen. I was filming Kiss the Girls at the time. I went straight to the set that night, told Gary Fleeter, the director, told the screenplay writer, told my agent, and no one listened. And there were all these systems that just not only tolerated, but enabled him, both men and women at the time.
Not just tolerated, but enabled him. Hannah, what's your reaction to the overturning of that conviction?
And everything that Kathleen said, it's just awful. My thoughts are with the victims. I think, to be honest, this feels like a, I don't know, kind of like this, like a kind of a course correction in a way. I think the Me Too was this big thing at this time. I kind of compare it a bit like to like the Black Lives Matter during that summer, George Floyd summer. I was like, oh, this is really loud, but it felt like a faddy sort of kind of change rather than saying this is in it for the long haul. So, you know, compare that with like Kevin Spacey recently, you know, getting off for his accusations of sexual assault, you know, the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial, which was an absolute, I might say S show, but it was awful to watch. It was really awful to see. And I think it just basically comes down to the fact that patriarchy will always reestablish itself. And I think this is what we're kind of seeing. I feel like this is, are you kind of hope in the background that systemic structures have been changed, like with workplaces that's made it better for women to be able to report stuff? You know, I know there's big things like at these studios, there's big change in that sort of way, but you're not really hearing about it. So for me, this just feels like, oh, you got a bit too loud. That's what it kind of feels like.
It's interesting to me that you compare it to the Black Lives Matter moment of 2020 and what you described as the George Floyd summer, because both of those moments in many ways felt like invitations for systemic change to come forth. It's invitations for organizations, for people to sort of take account and take stock of how they're behaving, how they're organizing themselves. And it felt like a turning point. That was the way that it was framed. Where do you think we're at with Me Too now, Hannah?
Well, I guess this is a thing. You kind of hope that like people listened a bit, like actual systems, like whether it's in the entertainment industry, whether it's in finance, whether it's in, you know, healthcare, like you kind of hope that there have been meaningful changes. But I think the problem is we see this thing, same with like diversity and inclusion. We see this as a faddy thing. It's like, oh, we'll hire like female writers to talk about this. We'll hire Black writers to talk. We'll hire Palestinian writers to talk about this thing now. But like, are you giving them work elsewhere? Like, are we actually doing meaningful changes to implement it so it becomes a kind of real proper change rather than, oh, we'll dip in and out just when it seems like appropriate? I mean, it kind of feels like a lot of things were maybe a bit more performative than they were actual, like really meaningful caring about stuff. It's all about looking good rather than actually doing the good work.
Kathleen, what's your read on where we are with Me Too right now?
Well, I mean, I agree with everything Hannah just said. It has felt like there's been this cultural shift in recent years that, you know, the incremental social progress that was made with the Me Too movement since 2017, which is, you know, what Hannah was referring to, that essentially women in workplaces and in Hollywood in this case deserve, you know, to not deal with harassment and sexual assault. And that if something horrible happened, they would be believed and supported and heard. And there seems to be this massive public pushback to that movement now. And, you know, we talk about cancel culture all the time, quote unquote. And I think that stems from a rejection of some of that progress. We use the word cancel to, instead of talking about men facing consequences for their actions, it's used as a way to, you know, deride the people who are trying to hold them accountable. And we even talk about the Me Too movement in the past tense, like women aren't still being sexually assaulted or harassed by powerful men in these industries. Just look at Diddy. We know that this is still happening. So it is really disheartening to see, I think, how the conversation has shifted.
Yeah, it's been really surprising to watch the Diddy case sort of play out quite publicly with none of the vernacular, none of the language that we learned from the Me Too moment sort of infused in it, because I thought, okay, this is a learning moment. This becomes like an instructive thing for us to take forward with us. And then, you know, 4 years later, 5 years later, you get to like a case like Diddy's, and like that language is really not present. Some of those learnings are really not present. Jackson, I want to bring you in here. This week you've been covering the Hot Docs Festival, and I heard that when the news about Weinstein broke, a particular film came to mind. Tell me a little bit about that.
I mean, I don't want to pair it too much of what's already been said, because Kathleen and Hannah covered it pretty excellently. But when this Hot Docs came up, one of the buzziest films, one of the most interesting films, the Japanese film Black Box Diaries, about a Japanese journalist, Shirai Ito, who documents her attempts to bring her rapist to account. And the whole language of this film is kind of resting on this tacit case, this Weinstein case. I've been an entertainment reporter for, I don't know, almost 10 years now. And you saw a very clear change in how we understood, spoke about, reported on these sorts of things after Weinstein. Obviously, sexual assault is much bigger than the world of entertainment, but you can't ignore the influence that pop culture has on the way that we understand things. And in this documentary, there's statements from like the United Nations, and there's Amnesty International statements on the regressive state at the time of Japan's sexual assault litigations, its justice system. And it's all kind of connected tacitly, unspoken, in some cases spoken, to things that are going on in the United States post-Weinstein. And regardless of what happens here, as you said, he's probably not going to get out of prison because of this other case that he's also been convicted in. But that chink in the armor that Kathleen and Hannah have spoken about, it's kind of legitimizing or galvanizing a sentiment that is literally, as I said, as Kathleen Hannah just said, a reversal on this change that happened when Weinstein's conviction first happened.
Kathleen, something that's really been interesting to me is also watching this play out on social media, because I feel like, at least in that front, we haven't gone back that far. You know, like at least on the social media front, you know, the discourse is still sort of like very supportive of Me Too, and that's what I'm seeing. That's what I'm encouraged by. But are you seeing something different? Are you seeing this case being relitigated in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, okay. I think Johnny Depp and Amber Heard is a good example, and I think
that's true.
The social media reaction to that was very much not in line with, I think, what we learned during the Me Too movement, which is still going. But yeah, I think what I've already seen so far, the relitigation, and Harvey Weinstein is like the big bad. He is the monster in all of this, right? There are 80 women who have come forward against this man. There is no debate, but already there's been a debate over this overturning and all of that, right? So I think that social media platforms have become more toxic in the past 7 years.
Yeah.
And I think that Twitter is going to be even more of a hellscape than usual. Since it became that, it's become worse. And I just hope, with social media and everything, with this quote unquote discourse, I hope people just remember that these are real people. These are real survivors. These are people whose lives and careers were allegedly destroyed by this man, who say they were victimized by him. And I hope people remember that before they fire off their hot takes.
Hannah, last word to you, just in terms of the way that this conversation is playing on social media, what are you noticing?
Can I be truly honest?
Please.
Is that I've been avoided. I've been taking an exit for Twitter. You know what? But can I just give you an example? Just that happened. A colleague of mine, a film critic colleague of mine, who reviewed the new Johnny Depp film for The Independent, she writes for. She literally screenshot. She didn't give it a good review. She screenshot, and she was getting abused and attacked by Johnny Depp fans because they gave him everything. And it's awful. So that's the kind of that's what I see. And this is why I am avoiding social media, because it shouldn't be like that. You'll be able to review a film and all that type of thing. So that's just what I'll say. Like a little positive thing that has maintained. Do you remember Frank Langella?
Yeah.
He filmed half of The House of Usher, and then he got kicked off after sexual harassment claims.
Yeah.
And they recast it. That is obviously, you know, wasn't too long ago, but like, that gives me a little bit more hope that even someone as big as him, they will literally recast a whole role. Must have been expensive. Should reshoot it to do it right. And obviously, you know, it's little things they could have worked in, like do the, just shoot one half and, you know, fix it in. But, you know, that to me does speak to about a system that has been put in place to make it better and hold people accountable. It is just such a long journey, though. And I wish it would just kind of quicken up. But.
Well, to give you an idea of how long a journey it is and it's going to be, the prosecution said they're going to try. They're allowed to retry Harvey Weinstein, and they said that they are going to retry Harvey Weinstein in these particular cases. And so this story is obviously not done yet, and we will come back and return to it. We're going to take a little pause, and then when we're back, we're going to talk about this new Zendaya movie.
Hey, I'm journalist Sam Sanders.
I'm poet Saeed Jones.
And I'm producer Zach Stafford, and we are the hosts of a podcast called Vibe Check.
On Vibe Check, we talk about everything. News, culture, and entertainment, and how it all feels.
That's right. We talk about any and everything on our show, from real-life issues like grief to music and movie critiques. And that barely scratches the surface.
Yes, indeed. And it doesn't stop there. We have got a lot to say. So join our group chat, come to life. Follow and listen to Vibe Check wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, there's going to be a change of tone in here. We are back. This is Commotion. Kathleen Newman-Bermang is here. Hannah Flint is here. Jackson Weaver is here. And we are going to get into the new movie from Zendaya. Let's get into it.
Hitting a ball with a racket is a great way to avoid having a job.
Well, that's also your problem. Because you think that tennis is about expressing yourself, doing your thing. That's why you still have that serve.
It works.
Yeah, but you're not a tennis player. But you don't know what tennis is.
What is it?
to relationship.
You know what I could listen to is Zendaya explaining what tennis is to me for a very, very long time. That is when the movie Challengers, also known on social media as the Zendaya tennis movie, I feel like this has been the shorthand that has been established, is directed by Luca Guadagnino. Hannah, I'm going to start with you on this movie. Let's talk about what kind of movie this is. Is it a sports movie? Is it a love movie? What are we watching? What do you watch when you go and watch Challengers?
D, all of the above. You know what I really like about this film is that, yes, it's a sports movie, but it's a vehicle for a really psychological, romantic, even kind of thriller.
Yeah.
In a way.
Ooh, it's, yeah.
You know what it really reminded me of? It reminded me of like Wuthering Heights.
Go on.
You know, the kind of love triangle with that kind of thing. You know, yeah. She's like Catherine Heathcliff and all that. And, you know, Meg Fass is the sappy one that she marries. But I guess what I really love about it is that, you know, it is about tennis, but it's about the passion of it. It's about, I guess, like this kind of just so much of the emotion and the thing that goes with to try and play in a sport at a higher level. I mean, I think it's the best, definitely the best, no shade to Wimbledon.
Some shade to Wimbledon, but okay, continue.
The closest that I've ever like been to like playing at any sort of high level of sports, I played basketball. I played England under 16 back in the day. And like one of my favorite movies is Love and Basketball. And there's like a scene in it where Monica is, and Gina Britt's wife, she does a perspective from Monica. She's on the court. You hear that internal monologue and you really understand the psychology of it. And I think a lot of films that are about sports don't get the psychology of winning. Get the pressure of it. And what I love about this is that, as she said, you know, tennis is a relationship, but everything about this is that the entire film is a match. It is a game that they're playing, whether it's off the court or on, like, you know, on the court. So yeah. I think it really captures that, and it just felt like it felt like we were just watching so much foreplay.
Yes.
It was like cinematic edging until the final act, and you're like, yes.
Yeah, I have to say, like, there's something magical about just Zendaya yelling the words "come on." That by the time that she does it at the end, you're like, "This is it. This is the best picture. This is the best picture of
this
the
is
year.
What we signed up for
this is what this is what I showed up to this movie theater for. Thank you for serving it for me. Exactly, Jackson. Listen, Hannah just mentioned the love triangle. Like, this is a classic movie trope. Does it work for you in Challengers?
It works so well. And the thing that like I love so much about it is this take that Hannah just said, where this is not really about, it's a love triangle that's not about love. It's also about love in the sense that it's trying to abstract love into its final form, which in this writer's idea is just the aspect of control. Who wins this relationship? And like, you get love triangles, a dime a dozen in movies, but this is that special kind of love triangle where each character gets equal measure, equal footing, and you decide based on like what you think is right and wrong in a person. Who's the hero? Who's the villain? And who's the victim of it? Like, is Tashi the hero or the villain for always taking control?
Tashi's a bad person, bro. Tashi's Zendaya's character. I walked away from me like, she's a monster. I love her. Great monster.
But that says like what you think about in life. Or do you think that somebody who is unapologetically in your face and getting what they need to get is like a paragon of humanity? Is Art the victim because he's like waifish and giving everything away? Or is he just, you know, does he know what he wants? Should Patrick have given up? Or is it commendable that he doesn't give up? But like, oh, Tashi being a villain is so interesting because you get all these movies where when women are like seen as in control of a relationship, a movie has to either explain or like subvert, comment on why that could have possibly happened. Why are we in this topsy-turvy world where the woman has the power in the relationship? Is it like in, you know, like Atonement, which is kind of a weird, not relationship, but an idea where a woman gets something over on a man? Is it because she's protected by her class? Is it protected by her like supposed innocent? Is it this Kung Fu Master, this Agnes Varda movie where she's like much older, something like The Reader as well? Like, why, how could this have happened? Challengers doesn't do that. She is the same age, same social status, like playing the same sport as them, but she directs them. You know, like if you've seen Itun Mama Tambien, that scene where she gets the guys to like,
but I appreciate the directing.
She does the same thing, but the whole idea is reversed, where she is in control, she's winning, she's guiding both of them. You might see that as villainous, but like, oh my gosh, it just, you make a decision for yourself, and that's what I love about this movie.
Jackson goes hard for Zendaya and Tashi, as we can see. Kathleen, I hear you want to talk about the kissing in this movie. We should all be talking about the kissing in this movie. Do you want to talk about why that is?
Don't I always? Just will say, I thought I was the biggest Tashi Duncan defender, but I think Jackie.
Let's go.
Yes. So yeah. The kissing. I mean, honestly, all I have to say is that the kissing in this film is top tier. It's some of the best.
We haven't seen kissing like this on screen for some time.
In a long time. Yeah. And that's truly, you know me, that's the highest endorsement I could give. The kissing is great. You should see it. But also, you know, I think the kissing, like everything else in this movie, is very passionate. It is foreplay. There isn't, you know, spoiler alert, like a big, massive sex scene necessarily, but no. The kissing, I think, adds to that edging and that foreplay, as we talked about. But I do also want to say this Luca quote that he gave recently, which he said, "It's beautiful to kiss people. People kiss, do not make war." And honestly, give the man all the money in the world to make whatever movies he wants.
Yeah. That's
genuinely.
I don't know, though. Yeah. That kissing, they went to war.
That's true. That was war via kissing 100%. Hannah, do you want to talk about Zendaya for a moment? Because, like, listen, she is in her imperial phase at the moment. Like, there is so much Zendaya, and it's working. For me, it's working. The fact that she keeps sort of, like, hitting one after one after one. The fact that Dune 2 still in theaters, and she's like, nope, another one. Here's Challengers. What do you make of the moment that Zendaya is having right now?
I think she has proven herself to make very good decisions on her films. Like, yes. I just, you know, everything that she's done. I mean, she started off with Disney, and she could have gone this big, like, franchise superhero thing. She did, obviously, Spider-Man. But, like, she did, like, Malcolm and Marie. She did Euphoria. Like, this film is kind of, I love it, because it's kind of, it's just, this weird, I mean, I love Luca Guadagnino. I just think he's great. I love that this kind of very European sensibility to the way that this film is shot. Yeah. But the fact that it's so erotic with minimal kind of like sexy, it's just a lovely dance. I think she's also just like, my thing is that they're all villains, because we all have a villain part of us.
It's a great take. I love that.
Go on.
They do mm-hmm. terrible things. People, it's the most realistic kind of presentation of Lunch Rider. We do terrible things. I'm like, maybe we aren't good. Like Mike Feist's character, you know, you think he's this like simp. To be honest, he's a bit of a cuck, but like but like he does very conniving bits. Like,
yeah.
And I love, because
I'm an art hater.
We have the same read.
I feel for him, though, because I get it. They all have terrible, like, just, I love that Josh O'Connor is normally the nice guy.
Josh O'Connor, his character, Patrick Zweig, he's the person I ride for, by the way. I read this movie and go, like, he's clearly the good guy in this, because he's very transparent about who he is.
But no, sorry to cut you off, Hannah. That's your problem, LME.
Exactly. Yes.
It's like,
go on.
You want a good guy and a bad guy. Yeah. That's why everyone doesn't get Dune. <'Cause it's> like, no one's go on. A good guy. They're all villains.
I don't think that's the case with Patrick. I think he was.
The point is.
Continue.
No, but he's even that. Like, I love about, and let's just go back to like, is it Justin Caritza's script?
Yeah.
Is that there's so much said in this film without being said in just a little line or anything.
Yes.
Like, you get it. Like, he presents himself as this like, oh, woe is me, like I can't afford stuff. It's like, dude, you went to like a private school, you have all this money. Like, I will say, Tashi, they're technically in a social class now, but like, they weren't. She came up, she's clearly a basis of like Venus and Serena, and like, she didn't come from money. Like, this is a different thing. For her to lose her career is massive. She doesn't, she didn't have, so now she has to live it through these white boys.
Yes.
And I think that line, like, you don't have to make anything about race. Just that one line was just like, you get it. Yeah. That's why she's not, like, for me, she's not the same as these guys. And these guys are kind of like, have this privilege that she doesn't have. Also as men, you know, as a woman, like, women don't get paid enough. They don't get enough support in tennis. Like, that's the reality of it. So there's so much in the backstory, the subtext that's going on that they managed to bring out in the performances. And I think the characters, like, they're all just do pretty terrible things, because the thing is, what they prize most is tennis.
And winning.
Even it's not about the, sometimes it's not about the winning. It's what she says. Like, it's that relationship of, like, with the game, and it's that thing, and it's playing. It's the playing at the best you could possibly play at. that has such an emotional response. And yeah, I think shout out to Justin, whose partner is Celine Song. So
yes, like, oh my gosh, I want to talk about that.
Celine Song, the director of Past Lives. Yeah. What a power couple, just in terms of the movies that they're writing. Kathleen, first of all, I can see that your dream has come true in that this is the one show where you're not the one saying the phrase, "That's your problem, Elamine," because that's normally the thing that we turn to you for. And that's fine. I want to give you 30 seconds to just talk about Zendaya's moment right now and the choices that she's making. Literally 30 seconds, and I got to go. Go.
Oh, I mean, I think that they're incredible. And I will say, I think one of the criticisms potentially of this film will be that Tashi's blackness isn't necessarily written into this script. It isn't like a central focus.
Yeah.
And I think that that's actually really smart of Zendaya. I think that that is why she has said she was drawn to this role, is because this is just a full, complex, messy character that Black women don't always get to be. And also that, you know, a lot of the times Black women are written as caricatures where their race is their entire identity. And Tashi's, that's not here. Like, she gets to be a full, messy villain or hero, whatever you think, human being.
Okay, before we go, I just want each of you to give me some recommendations, something I can take with me to this weekend. Jackson, what do you want to recommend?
Watching Hot Docs this week, and like definitely one of the standouts, Daughters, movie coming to Netflix this summer. It's about the Date with Dad program where girls are matched with or given the opportunity to meet their dads who are incarcerated in like a father-daughter dance. And it's so heartbreaking. Oh. And it follows both the father's attempts to like, you know, heal those relationships, but it also follows the daughters. And some of them are just like heartbroken over missing their father. Some of them filled with anger over their dads being in prison. It's just like, I don't know. It's beautiful, sad. Definitely check it out in the summer.
Just you giving that description alone has Kathleen on the verge of tears. So I'm going to go to her for her recommendation next. Kathleen, what do you recommend?
I almost cried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The Idea of You. It's a romance movie coming out next week on Amazon Prime, starring Anne Hathaway, Nicholas Galitzine. It is about a 40-year-old woman who meets the lead singer of the boy band her daughter is obsessed with. And
based
they start
on who?
A thing.
Start, name it. Based
Harry,
on who?
Harry Styles, the author, Robin Lee, has said it's multiple people, but Harry Styles is one of them. Listen, horny movies are back, baby. But if you don't want to wait for next week to watch it, I recommend the audiobook of the source material by Robin Lee, who is a Black woman, shout out, and an actor. She voices it, and it's fun and sexy and a great listen. Put your headphones in, carve out some private time. You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you for your recommendation. Also, if one thing Kathleen's going to do is ride for Anne Hathaway, I'd love to see it.
It's true.
Hannah Flint, last word to you. What do you want to recommend?
I feel like it's a really good time to look into Palestinian lives and their humanity. And there's a beautiful film come out this week called Alam, which is by, it's a feature director debut by Firas Khoury. And it's basically set in this kind of, this Galilee in a Palestinian Arab community. And some students are having to kind of engage with like a political awakening and sexual awakening as it kind of comes to this celebration of Israel's independence, which of course, Day of Independence was the Nakba for the rest of the Palestinian people. So I think it's a really tender, sensitive film, coming of age story that really kind of grapples with how the youth are not just the future, but for Palestinians, they're the present, trying to hold on to the past.
You guys are a delight. You bring me recommendations that make me laugh and make me cry and make me think. I appreciate you. Kathleen, Jackson, Hannah, thank you for being here. You guys are the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hannah Flint is a freelance TV and movie critic based in London, UK. Kathleen Newman-Burmang is deputy director of Refinery 29 Unbothered. She was in Toronto. And Jackson Weaver is a reporter at CBC's entertainment unit. And that is it for the podcast today. Listen, before we go, I just want to tell you about the incredible folks who helped get the show on the air. Commotion was produced this week by Stuart Berman, Ty Callender, Gene Kim, and Jess Lowe. Our digital producers are Amelia Ekbal and Julie Grossman-Gray. Our directors this week are Danielle Grogan and Jane Van Cooverden and Ty Callender. Our engineer is Sam Hashmi. Our senior producer is John Perry. And McKeegan is our executive producer. My name is Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud. I just want to say a thank you to Ali Hassan for filling in earlier this week for me. I really appreciate it. That's it for the show. We'll see you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.